I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up in our international briefing, we'll talk about the presidential election in Afghanistan. Now, we know that the status and rights of women are often a matter of intense and even violent disagreement in Afghanistan. But did you know that not one but two women are on the ballot there today? We'll tell you about their chances in a few minutes. But first, another matter that has claimed worldwide attention, the H1N1 virus, popularly known as swine flu. Medical industry leaders, public health officials, scientists, first responders, and others are meeting in Washington, D.C. today to talk about how to deal with the virus, prevention, preparedness, and recovery. The event marks the first international swine flu conference. Swine flu dominates the world's health agenda, largely because, unlike regular seasonal flu, the H1N1 virus has not retreated during the hot and humid summer months. It's infected more than 1 million Americans so far, followed by an outbreak in Argentina, where more than 300 deaths from the virus have been confirmed. We wanted to hear more about what the scientists and health officials are talking about and finding out, so we called Lori Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, and NPR science correspondent Richard Knox. Welcome to you both. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Lori, we heard so much about this earlier in the summer because in June, the World Health Organization declared a worldwide pandemic. What's the status now?
The virus, of course, as is normal with influenza, moved largely to the southern hemisphere. It tracks winter around the world. So it's spread rampantly throughout the southern hemisphere. We only have good data, of course, on countries that have strong public health systems like Australia and Chile. So the data is skewed and gives the impression that those countries have had the worst outbreaks. But, of course, for countries all across sub-Saharan Africa, we have mere whispers, hints and allegations, as Bob Dylan would have said. And we don't really know what is going on in sub-Saharan Africa. Meanwhile, two very strange things about this virus so far. One is that it has continued to circulate in the northern hemisphere, even though it's summer. And we've never really seen this kind of phenomenon with any influenza, certainly in my lifetime, but as far as I can tell, in recorded history. Mm-hmm. The UK actually had its strongest flu season, all occurring in the summer months. It's still rampant in Ireland and Scotland and Wales, only began petering out in the UK overall about a week ago. And that's just bizarre. We've never really seen it completely go away in the United States and Canada either. It's continued to circulate, although at much lower levels than what we saw in April, May, and June.
It's really interesting. And I take your point that the data sort of biases, if you will, toward countries that have better record keeping. So I completely take your point on that. But I was curious about Argentina and why the death toll has been as high as it has been there. Do we know? Do we have any idea?
Well, Argentina is a big mess. First, there is some indication that the virus has undergone some mutation. A group at Columbia University has identified 8 mutation point changes in the virus from samples taken from Argentina, but nobody's really been able to show that those mutations have any significance clinically. So we don't really know if that's in any way involved, but what we do know is involved is that Argentina has had real governance problems, very serious, deep governance problems for the last 4 or 5 years. And these have affected everything going on in the country, including resurgence of yellow fever, which had completely disappeared from Latin America back in the days of Walter Reed and Carlos Finlay. And now we have a resurgence for 2 years in a row of yellow fever in Argentina. We've seen resurgence of a number of other infectious diseases there. And it appears that a lot of the public health apparatus in Argentina has sort of fallen apart. And if in contrast, you go right next door to Chile, just the other flip side of the continent, if you will, they've had plenty of cases, but they've had tremendous public health management. No real crisis there at all, and that largely is because Bachelet, the president of Chile, is a PhD in public health and an MD and used to be the minister of health, and so the government has managed it magnificently.
That's interesting. I want to hear more about that. Richard, I want to bring you into the conversation. You, speaking of disparate impacts, you filed a report yesterday for NPR's All Things Considered where you zeroed in on the effect swine flu could have on minorities in the U.S. based on a report out of a particular city, Boston. Can you tell us more about what you found?
Yes, it is very interesting, and as far as I know, it's the first data suggesting this. The CDC is looking into the issue, but they don't really have any national data yet. I'm based in Boston, and it's a big medical community, big public health center, so they have pretty good figures. And they did an analysis about what the swine flu did in this past few months here, and it turned out that there's a really disproportionate effect on minorities, on African Americans and Latinos in particular. For instance, blacks represent about a quarter of the city's population, but 37% of the swine flu cases the confirmed swine flu cases. Latinos are 14% of the population, but more than a third of swine flu cases. So, you know, why is this? They're trying to puzzle it out. The biggest probable factor is that the Boston schools are mostly minority, even though the Boston population isn't yet. And this virus prefers young targets. We know that. And then compounding that problem, the health officials say, lower income parents have particular problems staying home to take care of sick kids because they don't get paid often if they do. So there were many contagious kids in classrooms this spring.
So you think it's something, so researchers think it's both the nature of the virus and also the social factors that you
not
just
really
want,
the
no?
nature. Excuse me. There's mm-hmm. no evidence so far that there's anything biological or anything either virological, the nature of the virus, or biological in terms of the susceptibility of minorities to the virus. I think these are social factors. They have to do with, you know, economics. They have to do with demographics, like who's in the school system, and they have to do with people's living situations.
But why you said earlier that young people are more at risk of getting it? Why is that?
Probably because people born before about 1947. Anyway, people under 57, I guess it would be. Have never encountered anything like this virus before. Their immune systems are totally naive to it. And so they don't have any protection at all against it. People my age, I'm over 52, do have some kind of protection. So something like 60% of all of the confirmed and probable cases of swine flu so far are under 50 years old, and half are under 24. So that's probably the main reason.
If you're just joining us, I'm sorry, Laurie, just let me jump in just briefly to tell listeners that if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about swine flu and efforts to contain a widespread outbreak this fall of H1N1 virus. And we're talking about how the virus is proceeding around the world. And our guests are Laurie Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, and NPR science correspondent Richard Knox. Laurie?
I wanted to ask Richard a question, if I may.
Sure.
Richard, when I heard your report on NPR yesterday, I wondered this immediately. We know the CDC has told us repeatedly, and so has WHO, that we see this virus having its most virulent impact on people who either are obese, have diabetes, or are pregnant. Since all three of those things track heavily with the socioeconomics and poor people are more likely to be in all three states, did they control for that in the Boston study?
I don't think they controlled for this. This was, they were making observations about who got sick. But I think going directly to your point is that they did find that hospitalizations were about twice as frequent. The rates of hospitalizations for swine flu among blacks and Latinos. And they think that's, one striking thing is half of the hospitalizations involved people with asthma. And we know that asthma in particular is rampant in African-American communities and also in Hispanic communities. So it's very much a kind of a double whammy. They're more likely to get it because of their situation and the demographics. And when they get it, they're more likely to end up in the hospital or to die.
Laurie, you had mentioned earlier that you had pointed earlier to the efforts of the Chilean government led by Michelle Bachelet in addressing the virus there. Have we learned anything else about best practices in containing this this virus that you can share with us?
Oh, I think all around the world we're learning a lot, actually. And I would say that the biggest take-home message I would give to our listeners right now is that at this moment, H1N1 in its current form, the state that it has evolved to at this point, is not a terribly dangerous virus. It's not in any place in the world killing lots of people, thank goodness. But it is a real test of globalization, a real test of our capacity to respond as a global community versus, you know, circling the wagons and responding as a country and not caring about what happens to anybody else. And in that sense, the lessons we're learning right now are very, very distressing. What we're learning is that when a pandemic hits, and just think about what this would mean if we were looking at a really lethal pandemic on the scale of 1918. When a pandemic hits, nations take care of their own. Rich nations take care of rich nation residents. Poor nations suffer deeply. There are commitments made. They are hot air. Nothing gets to the poor countries. Nobody cares about the poor countries. Nobody is doing surveillance. Nobody is taking care of those people. Africa is a giant black box. We have HIV rampant across Africa. We have tuberculosis rampant across Africa. Richard mentioned asthma as a risk factor. We know any respiratory illness is a risk factor for having more dangerous outcome with influenza, but nobody is doing a darned thing about it. And that's the take-home message of this pandemic.
Okay.
It is,
Lori, I'm sorry. I need to interrupt because I also need to give. I also need to let Richard give a last word from his take-home from the briefing he attended on the disparate impact on what was discovered in Boston. What were health officials telling us there, as briefly as you can, please?
Following up on what Lori was just saying, I think we're going to see some really difficult problems coming up with regard to who gets the vaccine for this new disease when it becomes available later this fall. At the recent meeting at the CDC, there was really no discussion about the special targeting of minority populations because these data hadn't come out, but that's going to be a problem.
Richard Knox is NPR science correspondent. He joined us from his home office in Boston. We were also pleased to be joined by Lori Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. She was kind enough to join us from her home office in New York. Thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
Yeah.